Part 2. Chapter 6. Warm Waters. Because seeking arrangements is private and free, a lot of people who are interested in sex work have their first experience there. I wanted to see if I was actually capable of doing the work. If it didn't go well, then I wouldn't have even shown my face to anyone. I could have simply deleted my profile and walked away. I will always remember my first client very fondly. After setting up my account, I was inundated with messages, some of them rude and abusive, others so grandiose I was sure they were a scam. One guy stood out who seemed kind and eager about the whole thing, like he enjoyed paying for it, like the money was something he relished giving me as opposed to a tedious formality he tried not to think about. I met up with him for lunch. I told him that, for the first meeting, I wanted to just talk and see if we were compatible, and that I wouldn't be heading back anywhere with him. He happily agreed, and we ate somewhere I later learned was right in between my startup's office and his home. He told me he ran a few strip clubs and that he loved taking care of the girls. I liked him. When I got back to my computer at work, I immediately messaged him, asking if he'd want me to come over to his place sometime that week. His apartment was beautiful and had a smattering of BDSM equipment lying around, from his ex, he said. We went to the bedroom after chatting for a bit. We kissed and took off our clothes and I gave him a blowjob and we fucked. We cuddled for a bit after. I was buzzing with excitement. I loved it. It was absolutely intoxicating. We hadn't negotiated a price, but he handed me $500 in cash and a $20 for my cab home. On the ride back, I stared at the cash in my hand. It felt incredible to have earned so much in 30 minutes. Easy money. I had wondered if I would feel a sense of shame, of dirtiness. Instead, I felt happy. I had made this sweet older man's evening, helped him feel cared for, and in exchange, he cared for me as well. I wouldn't have to be nearly as anxious about money this month. I think some people don't realize what an act of love taking care of someone financially is. Giving someone money is a way of adding a little ease to their life. It is giving them control. Maybe they want to save it. Maybe they want to treat themselves to something special. Maybe it'll let them pay their electricity that month or get them a room for that night. Directly giving someone money is a sign of trust, that they know best what they want and what they need. I saw that client quite a few times after that. Once, he invited me over to a party he was having with some of the girls from his club. He went into the bathroom to do lines with them, seemingly embarrassed but happy I wasn't indulging. "You're a good kid," he said. He introduced me to a beautiful older woman nursing a drink on his couch. I asked her what she did. "I'm a masseuse," she said, uncomfortable. I went on an embarrassing tangent about how masseuses are such healers as she sighed. I missed the euphemism. He and I stopped seeing each other as much as I became more professional. I think he liked nurturing new girls. I felt very lucky to have seen him and glad that I went with my gut. The next few clients I was a little less discriminatory about. I knew that good ones were out there and I wanted to see all of the possibilities. The next man I met called himself a tech entrepreneur. He suggested a fancy restaurant downtown to meet for lunch near all the shopping. He was reserved, handsome, intense. He told me he was raised Catholic. "That's exactly my type," I said, smiling. After we were done eating, he called us an Uber. Uber was still a relatively new phenomenon at this point, and the drivers still wore suits. "I'm friends with Travis," he said. He helped me up into the massive black SUV, showed me a list of stores he wanted to take me to. "I'm thinking business sexy," he said. "Pencil skirts, almost sheer blouses." I did a little striptease for him in the changing room, and he moaned involuntarily. There's something so alluring about those formerly Catholic men, their desperate horniness, the naughtiness. He toyed with his wedding ring as his cock pressed an outline into his pants. I straddled him. He asked if we could go to a hotel. He booked the Four Seasons on his phone. He brought everything out to the salesman and handed him his black card, put his hand around my waist, and squeezed. Back at the room, he kissed me, gently, holding back, slowly peeled off my clothes, kissing my bare skin as it was unveiled. I pressed myself into him, smelling his cologne. "God," he murmured. We were both in our underwear. "You're so wet," he said, looking at me. I slowly crawled across the bed away from him, teasing him with my ass, and he followed me, flipped me onto my back, and I could feel his hard cock through his briefs. "I want to make you come," he said, slowly removing my panties, pressing his face into my bush, his tongue into my cunt. "I want you to fuck me," I said, sliding a finger under the elastic as if to strip him. He pulled back. "I don't fuck on the first date," he said, with a devilish smile. I love a man who knows just how to rile me up. Why do so many men treat sex like they are a starving man at a buffet? They gorge themselves on sex as though they will never eat again, until their cocks are chafed and desensitized. They watch porn for hours upon hours, gripping their cocks in a death grip, as though this next orgasm will save them from having to ever ponder those dark existential questions haunting the backs of their minds. It's so much sexier to fuck someone who savors it, who holds you in suspense, who moves with intention. And their intention is not just to get off, or to feel better about themselves, or feed their ego, but to feel pleasure. True, utterly obliterating and consuming pleasure. When sex can be a game, and both people are fully cognizant players. When you meet someone's eyes across the room, and you are immediately overwhelmed by the desire in their eyes. Desire is something that needs to be cultivated, nurtured, knowing that you both want it, but you're holding back. I think of how many men whine that their wives are sexless and dull. Whenever someone tells me that, I fantasize about seducing their wives. No wonder that is the greatest fear of some of these men. How easy it would be to meet her at a dinner party, make that long and intense eye contact, put your hand on the small of her back or the back of her arm, whisper jokes in her ear, compliment her smell, make no overt moves. Maybe she'll fuck him that night, thinking of you. The rest of my sugar daddies were far less exciting. There was a man who wined and dined me, dropped $10,000 taking me shopping, booked a suite at the Ritz, only to say, "I won't use condoms." I walked out. Another man took me on multiple dates. I told him every time about some bill I was worried about paying, and he was like, "Wow, that sucks." Then eventually he sent me a text asking why I didn't fuck him. I joined the site to find someone who is interested in taking care of me financially, so that I can take care of them in return. "Oh," he said, "I didn't realize I would have to do more than pay for dinner." And that was the end of that. I had been dipping my toe into sex work for around 3 months when people in alt-lit began accusing major figures of rape and sexual assault. Anna was one of the people who was accused, as were most of the men who had attempted to fuck me while I was underage. She had written an account of how she had previously violated the consent of many people she had dated, and how she was learning and trying to do better. A girl stepped forward, showing screenshots of sexual messages Anna had sent her while she was underage, trying to hook up. Anna told me that it was a lie, scrolled through their message history. At the time, I didn't consider that she may have deleted key messages. Friends reached out to me, asked whether I was safe, encouraged me to leave Anna. I vented to one of my friends about Anna, telling him that I felt overwhelmed, that Anna had pressured me into sex as well, but that she was refusing to discuss it with me. Anna, who had my Facebook password, read the messages and blew up at me. She accused me of talking shit behind her back. She messaged the friend angrily. She told me I had to cut him off or that our relationship was over. I didn't know what to do. I certainly didn't want to become homeless. Everyone I knew in San Francisco, I knew through Anna. I couldn't go back to my parents. Mentally, I shut down. I blocked everyone on Facebook. I quit my day job after my boss started asking me questions about the accusations. I still feel ashamed about how I handled the situation. Looking back, there were friends I could have crashed with, people who would have taken me in while I got back on my feet. But I was terrified, and in many ways, the dynamic with Anna felt familiar. She was older, and she seemed to have her shit somewhat together. It has been hard for me to accept that I was also groomed and abused, that even though I liked it at the time, the attention Anna paid me while I was underage was totally inappropriate. I was not as mature as I thought I was, as she told me I was. Even given all of that, the actions I took harmed others. Even if I was being abused myself, I carelessly invalidated the experiences of others and I defended Anna publicly and privately. I destroyed treasured relationships with friends who had been there for me for years. It is only recently that I started to reach out and apologize. It has been painful and scary and humbling. It's so easy to let yourself believe that extenuating circumstances can completely absolve you of any wrongdoing. You only hurt someone because you are hurt, sad, afraid, because it was the only way you thought you could survive. Even if those things are true, it is still important to own the mistake and ask for forgiveness and try to make it right however you can. This is something I am still working on. After quitting my tech job, armed with the beautiful lingerie and designer clothing purchased by my sugar daddies and some new photos taken by Anna in our apartment, I posted my first ad on Eros, a public ad site. My face was blurred. I got my first inquiry that very night and arranged a booking for the next week. The first client to book me off of Eros suggested a potential double with a girl whose ads I had seen around, Lauren. She was pretty and blonde, and I asked if she wanted to meet up. While we were getting tea together, a horde of 20 cops walked by, and both of us froze, instantly tense and uncomfortable. It was my first time meeting with another provider, and I was terrified they might have overheard and would arrest us, which, looking back, I now see as patently ridiculous. People always treat my job like the appointments with clients are the interesting bits. That's inevitably what they ask about. What is your worst booking? What is the weirdest thing you've been asked to do? Have you ever fallen in love with a client? As with most jobs, the work itself is rarely the most interesting bit. To me, the part that is the most intriguing is the politics surrounding the work. My relationships with my colleagues and how my anxieties have been transformed during the time I've been working. I used to be so worried that people would know, that they could tell who I am and what I'm doing, and what the consequences of that knowledge would be. When I first started, I think many people really could read the situation at a glance. What is a young woman doing hanging off the arm of an old man in the hotel lobby? To be honest, even then, no one particularly cared. And I think those that did feared the consequences of being wrong. What if we were a particularly affectionate father and daughter, or colleagues who had had a bit too much to drink? It would be too embarrassing to miss the mark with a confrontational accusation. As I got to know Lauren, I learned that she had gotten into the industry while she was underage. More than a few of the sex workers I've met while working started out that way. Often it was people who had a strained relationship with their parents, moved out early, and needed a way to make money fast. I know some people who did it for a short period, then left for another job when they could. Others stuck to it because it suited them. I imagine an alternate timeline where my teenage nightmare of being homeless because I was queer actually happened. I'm fairly certain I would have become an underage sex worker then, too. No one I knew who started while underage was honest with their clients about it. They always said they were 18 or 19, if not 21. They had fake IDs and everything else. What is the solution here? Prohibitionists point to underage sex workers and insist this is why the industry must be eliminated. But what other choice did my friends have? Often they were turned away by shelters, wanted the semblance of a normal life, or wanted to afford to go to college. Even with student loans and scholarships, a part-time job, How many teenagers, unsupported by their parents, could afford tuition, housing, and food? Prohibitionists, in general, tend to say that the entire industry is rotten and exploitative, that no one could possibly enjoy this work in any form. What right do they have to speak over actual workers in the industry? How many bureaucrats working at insurance companies, systematically denying coverage to customers, enjoy their job? What is more soul-crushing, getting paid minimum wage to tell someone they can't afford a life-saving medical treatment, or getting paid $50 to give some asshole a blowjob? It probably depends on who you ask. All the time, I have civilian friends tell me how jealous they are of how much money I make, of how the work is so easy. They're jealous of my glamorous Instagram, my travel, my spa days. Of course, when I ask them why they don't do it themselves, well, there's always a reason. The reality is, the public-facing persona has to look easy. So much of the job is making it seem easy and effortless. There's a perennial debate about whether or not sex work would exist under communism. It's a tiresome question. There will always be people who want to pay for sex. There will always be people willing to sell it. Something more interesting, under communism, how many people would voluntarily work their current jobs? How many are satisfied with their current working conditions? How many people would want to scrub toilets, work in a call center, pee in a bottle for Amazon? The debate about sex work is a strange fixation. Many people only work their current jobs because of economic pressures. What is the best way to ensure that women are not trafficked into brutal sexual slavery? There's many things that need to be done. To avoid people turning to sex work in times of desperation, we need a more robust social safety net. We need healthcare, childcare, food, and housing for all who need it. We need to fight against homophobic, racist, sexist, transphobic work environments. We need to support survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and all other forms of abuse. We need immigration reform. Before I read Laura Augustin's incredible Sex at the Margins, I assumed that most undocumented workers who do sex work were forced into it. This couldn't be further from the truth. Those who are trafficked across borders often incur a debt they need to pay to the ones who get them across. They are paying for a service and often feel a responsibility to pay it. Undocumented women have two easily accessible career options, cleaning or sex work. Both are easy to do under the table, but sex work pays far better. If they want to make money fast, many choose sex work. We need criminal justice reform. Many sex workers have a criminal record that prevents them from getting a regular job. I have a few friends who were, quote-unquote, rescued in a trafficking sting. They ended up being charged with prostitution and can't even get a job bagging groceries. The cops terrorize sex workers. Sex workers are more likely to experience violence at the hands of the police than from our clients. Because I had, in one fell swoop, cut off so many of my friends, I threw myself into my friendships with Anna's friend group and the new sex workers I was meeting. At the time, it was trendy for sugar babies and escorts to keep a Tumblr blog to document their adventures. Lauren's blog was very popular. I was always curious about whether or not she would mention me on there, so I'd read it from time to time. She didn't tell me it was hers at first, but I could tell it was because on the day we met, she wrote a blog post about a sex worker she met for the first time and how nervous she was. The next time we hung out, we got ice cream together at a very Instagrammable shop. I asked her if she was dating the girl who was in most of her photos on social media, saying they were very cute together. Lauren insisted she was straight, but said she loved her friend more than anything. I asked if when they were drunk, they made out, and she asked how I knew. She came over for brunch once and sat at the kitchen table while I cooked, mimosa in hand. While waiting for the pancakes to cook, I came over and sat on her lap. She pressed her nose into my hair and breathed in deeply. "You smell so good," she said. I laughed and kissed her cheek. "I was crying all last night because I'm not a lesbian," she told me. If you want to be a lesbian so bad, then maybe you just are one, I replied. Do you want to grab my boobs? She cupped my boobs in her hand and squeezed, giggling and smiling. A few weeks later, I invited a girl, Melinda, that I had a mutual client with, to one of the brunches. It was becoming a regular thing, inviting fellow sex workers over for a weekday brunch. She seemed intimidated by me. I thought she was cool and wanted to be friends, but she seemed intent on a weird and combative dynamic. Afterwards, she wrote a long rant on Tumblr about her clients who see girls with big boobs but ask her not to get implants. I was worried she was writing about my boobs and our mutual client. He never booked me again. Because I was just starting out and he was my only regular so far, it was a big hit to my income. I told Anna that I was pissed off at Melinda. Oh, I doubt she said anything to him, Anna said. Stop being paranoid. Years later, after I moved to New York, I visited San Francisco for a tour. This client reached out to me again and asked for a dinner date. Over dinner, he apologized that it had been so long. He told me Melinda had been jealous of me and asked him to stop seeing me. The client who asked for a double with Lauren never ended up following through. I had a second inquiry, this time for a booking with a girl who had similar branding. We both obviously admired French New Wave. I asked her if she would get a coffee with me before the booking. When she walked over, I was shocked. She looked exactly like Zazie, a writer I was obsessed with and totally idolized in high school, who I once met at a reading. I'm sorry if this is weird to say, I told her, but you remind me of a writer I knew. Who? She asked. Do you know Zazie? Zazie had gained notoriety in the lit scene in NYC for writing thinly veiled and devastating accounts of her interactions with well-known writers. I worshipped her writing. She had been a major inspiration for much of my work in my senior year of high school. She seemed a little surprised, but told me she was indeed Zazie. I tried to avoid fangirling too hard, but I told her I was a massive fan of her work. She was so sweet about it. And so my first double session was to be with the writer who partially inspired my interest in sex work in the first place. It felt so elegant. I gushed about meeting her to Anna, who surprised me by being negative about the whole situation. Don't get too friendly with her, she said. Why? If she figures out who I am, she might tell our new friends I'm a rapist. I can't start all over again. Zazie and I met our client in a business hotel in downtown San Francisco. It was crowded and we easily slipped up the elevator to his room. During the session, Zazie was shy but charming. I was infatuated. It was a quick one-hour booking, and then we were together on the street, waiting for our respective Ubers. I asked her if she would come to karaoke with me sometime. Oh, I'm too anxious for karaoke, she said. I felt sad, and I think she could tell. I really want to be your friend, she said, taking my hand. My worst client turned stalker started seeing me in my first summer. He saw me first at a hotel, telling me it was so I wouldn't know where he lived. I work in Google's security division, so I'm a little paranoid, he emailed. He also asked if I was comfortable seeing a client with disabilities. Presumably he was decent at his job, but he was also an idiot. The first time I saw him, he asked me a laundry list of obviously suspicious questions. What's your date of birth? What high school did you go to? Where were you born? I didn't answer any of his questions, of course, or answered them with lies. The only one I answered truthfully was my age, which I thought was harmless. He bragged to me about compromising the security of another girl's site and figuring out her legal information. I tried to have sex with him, but he flipped out, saying he was too anxious to do anything sexual. He didn't reveal what his disability was. I wondered what it was. I just want you to lie on top of me, he whined. I continued to see him, both out of a desire to observe the strange human and because the money was good. He was weird. His apartment was grotesque and sad, with a towel in his bathroom that had a brown streak in the middle. It looked like it hadn't been washed in years. His bedroom was depressing. Bed with no headboard, permanently unmade, sheets stained. The whole apartment smelled of sickly BO, of depression. The first few times I met him, he just wanted me to lie on top of him and kiss him. He was a terrible kisser. His breath was odd, almost smelling like whatever antiseptic they used to clean hospitals. He would ask me to watch YouTube videos with him. He kept pushing for information, for photos of my face, but I turned him down every time. I found sessions with him strange but tolerable. I told myself it was touch therapy for him. Then he wanted to have sex. He revealed his disability. His muscles were extremely tight, so he was less flexible than normal. I did my best to maintain a neutral facial expression. His cock was the most disgusting I have ever seen. I have seen many. It was poorly washed, so usually I would wipe it with a wet washcloth before I started. It smelled even after being cleaned and was limp, yet oozing pre-cum. I put it in my mouth. "Please go more slowly," he demanded. His sausage limp in my mouth, my hand slowly stroking it as his gunky pre-cum dribbled from the tip. I wondered if it was possible that I might die from how disgusting it was. When he came, his cum was slightly yellow and chunky. It was so revolting, I vomited in my mouth as I watched it. He lay in his bed, moaning and twitching. Why did I continue to see him? Of course, money, which at the time I had great need of. I also pitied him. Maybe I was helping him, being there for him. He eventually convinced himself we were in a relationship. He asked to see me off the clock, to take me shopping. I gently told him no, and he pitched a fit. "I would be doing this for you, to spoil you," he sounded like a 5-year-old having a temper tantrum. "If you really wanted to make me happy," I said, "you would give me the shopping money and stay at home." He started crying. I went to leave the apartment, and he clung to me. I slowly peeled his hand off my wrist and walked out the door. He wouldn't stop emailing me. The emails became increasingly deranged. I blocked his email. Then he started DMing me on Twitter. I responded only to tell him not to contact me further. He made a fake account pretending to be an escort and DM'd me once again. Once I realized it was him, I blocked him. After this, there was a brief period of peace. Then he found my dating profile. To find my dating profile, this man would have had to have gone through every profile for women my age in the Bay Area. From there, he was able to use his special role at Google to stalk me extensively. He found my LinkedIn using some sort of facial recognition search, which was the only social media account I had forgotten to make private. After getting my legal name, he was able to find my address, Anna's name, old art projects I had made in high school and college. He began emailing me vague threats, telling me he knew where I lived. My first instinct was to panic. Then I realized that even if he did come to my home, there was no way he could take me in a fight. I ignored all the emails, sent them to spam once again. Again, there was a period of silence for a month or so before he figured out how to redirect my number. Because he was a Google employee, he was able to redirect my messages and phone calls to a Google Voice account. I realized this perhaps 20 hours in when I found I wasn't getting calls and Anna reached a strange voicemail when calling me. Eventually, Verizon had to prevent my phone number from being accessed online because someone with an IP address in Mountain View, California, kept redirecting my calls. The only contact I get from him anymore is an occasional weird note telling me I changed his life, that he wishes he could see me again. Anna was beginning to chafe against the couple's therapist, who seemed to her to be too critical of our relationship. I had started to speak up about wanting to use the Hitachi a bit more, as our sex was sometimes painful, and the Hitachi was extremely effective at making me orgasm. I hadn't yet told Anna that I was rarely able to orgasm with her sans vibrator. The couple's therapist mentioned a few sex therapists we could see together, or that I could see solo, who were experienced at helping people through such things. She questioned Anna why the Hitachi was so threatening and offensive. Wouldn't you want your partner to experience pleasure? Anna told me that the couples therapist was discriminating against us due to our age gap. She thought Anna was abusing me. I disagreed. I didn't see it. I just thought Anna was being an ass about the Hitachi, and perhaps the therapist agreed with me. And Anna was being an ass. She would pitch a fit like a six-year-old when I asked to use the Hitachi. It was uncomfortable for her. It wasn't intimate enough for her. She would usually wear me down in these verbal battles, but as I began to work more, my vagina couldn't take it. She would get excited if I yelped in pain. I asked if it got her off, my pain. Honestly, it is hot that I'm rough enough that it hurts you a little. But it didn't just hurt a little. Eventually, I just said that if she wasn't comfortable using the Hitachi, then I couldn't have sex with her. You're violating my consent, she said. What? I asked. How? If you will only have sex with me with the Hitachi, then you're forcing me to use it. I sat down on the bed. I am saying that I only consent if the Hitachi is used. I am fine with us not having sex if you do not consent if the Hitachi is used. You are the one who asked to have sex. You are the one who is now pressuring me to engage in a type of sex that physically hurts me. She pouted. She cried. She begged me to reconsider. Eventually, the couple's therapist proposed seeing me mano a mano, one-on-one, sans Anna, and Anna and I could find someone else as a couple's therapist. I was starting to process some childhood trauma I'd pushed down deep before, so I was into the idea of seeing this therapist solo. I'm sorry to get so meta here, dear listener, but as juicy as the details of my traumatic childhood may be, I'm not going to pretend this little memoir is any more confessional than it really is. I really do need to keep some sort of mystery about me. It was wonderful seeing her one-on-one at first. I grew even more certain that she used to be a dominatrix. She had all sorts of helpful tips related to sex work. She told me to go to one of the Korean spas in San Francisco and get a body scrub. At first, I pushed back. It's too expensive. I can't afford it, I said. She looked at me, bewildered. I was still splitting all my expenses with Anna, and I wasn't making nearly as much as I do now. Well, she said, please try to make room in your budget for it. Since becoming a sex worker, so many of my views on stereotypically feminine things have changed. I looked so different before I started. Being conventionally attractive was, when I was younger, not a goal for me. I recently showed a beloved client some photos from my time in college, and he looked at me, shocked. Did you get a nose job? He asked. Or some other surgery? I laughed. No, but I lost my baby fat, treated my acne, and plucked my eyebrows. Style and grooming are far more important to looking conventionally attractive than many people think. A good haircut and color, trimming of the eyebrows or facial hair, the right lipstick, a touch of concealer. They can transform someone from looking totally average to a stunning beauty. I think people today are so used to women wearing makeup that it can shock people to see someone who doesn't. Taking care of your body is an important part of the work. I had a client who once told me he was massaged for an hour 3 times a week. His skin was soft and smooth like a baby, his muscles without tension, smooth like a pampered Wagyu cow. I couldn't stop stroking him. I do Pilates or yoga 3 times a week. I am always exfoliating. My face, my body, chemical and physical exfoliants both. I go to the spa, sweat it out in the steam room, plunge in the cold pool. I have been peeled and microneedled and infused. At one of my favorite Korean spas, they even offer a service where they steam your pussy. In this industry, it's important to take care of your body, not simply for aesthetic reasons, though those are important, but also for your mental health. At first, I resisted my therapist's suggestion to get a massage or go to the spa. I viewed such activities as indulgent and expensive. There were more important things for me to spend my money on. The first time, I finally caved and went to a spa for the first time. I was incredibly anxious. While soaking in the tub, I kept glancing at the clock, promised myself I would try to stick it out for an hour. I left the spa after 15 minutes. Going to the spa became easier as I grew more in tune with my body. I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and at times the symptoms were overwhelmingly painful. I would have joints randomly sublux as I walked down the street, my hip suddenly no longer properly in its socket. I had started physical therapy, and the process was grueling. I felt so weak. It was only after 3 years of physical therapy that my PT said I was strong enough to switch from a therapeutic setting to regular Pilates. I resisted. Wasn't there some other sort of exercise I could do? I associated Pilates with the grading blonde moms of the students in my middle school. But I went, and of course, like many things I initially resist, I ended up loving it. Watching my body become more powerful and learning how to exercise delicate control over every movement gave me a new appreciation for it. For so long, I had treated my body with anger and disgust, resentful that I needed to inhabit it at all. I began to go to the spa and actually enjoy it, taking pleasure in feeling my muscles react to the heat, to the cold, to touch. When you are a sex worker, your body is your work. Caring for it and maintaining it is a part of the job. If you aren't familiar with the industry, you might think it's rife with STIs. Ultimately, anyone who has sex is opening themselves up to the chance of getting an STI. Even if you are in a monogamous relationship, your partner could be carrying something from a previous relationship or could even be unfaithful. Whores aren't stupid. According to numerous studies, we actually have far lower incidences of STIs compared to the general population. Most of my friends in the industry get tested frequently, even if they use condoms religiously. Plenty of us are on PrEP as well. When I first asked my doctor about starting PrEP, they gave me a funny look. I had been seeing them for a year, and they knew I got tested every 3 months. "Have you ever had an STI?" they asked. "No." "You honestly probably don't need to use it. Based on the number of people you have sex with, if you haven't gotten anything yet, you probably use condoms properly and don't need to have any extra protection." Nevertheless, I got the prescription. I had no side effects, so there was no reason for me not to take my Truvada pill every morning. I felt so much safer. My porn career would be over if I ever tested positive. Enforcing condom use with my clients is relatively easy, even if some do protest. Honestly, I only really have condomless sex with other performers on set. There is trust there. With clients, I would never, even if they produce a negative test. Results can be faked, and I would feel the need to get tested even more frequently. Some clients are truly delusional. They have no idea how to manage risk. There are forums where some of them discuss getting BBFS, or bareback full service, their slang for sex without a condom. The things they write are truly disgusting. One man wrote about a bareback session where he immediately went back to his car and doused his cock in Purell to, quote-unquote, kill the AIDS. Another client, a doctor, was arguing with me about using a condom. I asked him when the last time he had gotten tested was. "I've never had to get tested. I'm safe." The state of sex education in America is truly dismal. The hardest part of the work for me, and I think for many other sex workers, is maintaining our boundaries. Most of my clients are lovely, but some will push every boundary you have. Emotional, physical, whatever they can. "Do you love me? What's your real name? Let's skip the condom. I know you said you don't do anal, but..." For some, the boundary pushing is specifically what they enjoy. If you want to last in the industry, you get good at saying no firmly, but gently, so as not to hurt anyone's feelings. Imagine a mother coaxing a toddler in a temper tantrum. Occasionally, clients even change their behavior after watching you enforce a boundary. Sometimes they push just to see if they can. If you show that you won't have any of it, they gain respect and stop acting out. When I was new, I would sometimes think that giving in and giving them what they want would make the rest of the session go more smoothly. It never did. They think you're a pushover. They'll just keep pushing. I have friends who will show up to every session and intentionally act like a bitch, rude and cranky, and watch how the client responds. If he does his best to be chill, she'll continue seeing him. If he's an asshole in response, she'll never see him again. Personally, I like being sweet too much. I'm always kind, unless the client requests otherwise, but I don't hesitate to lay down the law the moment I need to. If you do online sex work, maintaining boundaries is equally challenging. The moment I began showing my face, I blew up on Reddit. I hit the front page and suddenly people from my high school were texting me about it. It wasn't my intention to have a porn career, but suddenly people were calling me a porn star. As someone who grew up on 4chan, an anonymous internet forum with the most edgy content one can imagine, I have a very thick skin. When people accused me of being a narcissistic whore, I laughed. How unimaginative, I thought. My favorite insult. She must think she has a gold-plated pussy to be charging those prices. I think some of the internet nerds were at first entranced that I was invulnerable to trolling. I didn't, quote-unquote, get mad. I trolled back. I knew the culture, and I could turn their insults back on them. The thing about most internet trolls is that they are just sad, lonely kids. I never engaged in mass trolling as a kid. I was always just a lurker, but I knew people who did. So sometimes I could even have vulnerable conversations with my trolls. Like my clients who misbehaved at first. Once they saw I smacked them down and didn't take any of their shit, their behavior changed. A common joke about people who are on 4chan in the early days is that either you grew up to be a full-on Nazi or a cool queer person. That site was vile and intense. It drew people to it who were deeply wounded and felt misunderstood. There was gore, racism, bigotry in general, suicide, and sometimes people would even post child pornography. The worst of the internet. Being exposed to that as a child certainly had its influence on me. But it also had some of the best aspects of the internet at the time. All the top-tier memes originated on 4chan. It was also where I learned that trans people existed. Of course, 4chan used slurs to refer to them, but they were there. People would debate politics, so I learned about Chomsky and all the other popular anarcho-communists. I was linked to Arrowhead, so I was safe when I experimented with any drugs. So when someone calls me a dirty whore, I don't take it personally. It would be hard for me to see that as anything other than them lashing out in pain. So I would call them a loser incel who hates women because he can't get laid, and they would clap back, calling me an entitled bitch, and I would say, why shouldn't I be? Then, usually a few minutes later, they would respond saying something like, I am just sad and angry and lonely. And I would send them internet hugs and DM them, chat for a little bit. Sometimes people just need to be held, even if it's over the internet. My understanding of plastic surgery has also changed dramatically since working in the industry. When I was young, I thought of it as something vain and therefore sinful. As I grew older and my feminism broader, I thought of it vaguely as something that people choose to do, and it was fine. I never really considered it for myself, even after I started working. It seemed too expensive, and besides, Anna was always harshly against it. Hilariously, many of my shitty early clients were also obsessed with it, and particularly vicious when describing it. I had clients beg me to never get anything done, saying it would ruin me, or compliment me for being quote-unquote natural, saying they were disgusted by other women, despite the fact that I knew many of the ladies they frequented and claimed to love had had plenty of work done. It was laughable in many ways. The clients who were most obsessed about whether boobs were fake or not were also the ones who frequently deluded themselves about whether the experience of hiring an escort as a whole was a fantasy or not. Of course, sometimes we enjoy our time with clients, but part of our job is giving them that fantasy of a perfect date. Most clients understand this and are appreciative of the effort, suspend their disbelief in kind. Some, however, become increasingly neurotic about the entire experience. Do you really like me? Did you come? Are you sure? I want you to really like me. Do you think you would ever date me? Few things irritate me more than a pretentious man fancying himself a genius who is in reality an idiot. These men can be encountered in all walks of life, boisterously proclaiming their superiority through every word, because nothing arouses them more than their own obnoxious voice. One of these men once accused me of trying to steal his semen, as though nothing would give me more satisfaction than carrying his child. I laughed. He was trying to flush the condom, the absolute idiot, so I made him carry it out of the hotel in a tissue paper so that he wouldn't clog the toilet. I lectured him, letting him know that I made more money than him, and anyways, had no desire for his paltry child support, much less his repulsive spawn. Few things make me lean into my mean streak more than condescension. Of course, some sex workers end up dating their clients, just as someone might date anyone they met at work. However, it is unwise to go into any commercial operation with the goal of it ending in a date. It is as foolish to try to hire a plumber based on his looks with the hopes of marrying him one day as it is to do so with a sex worker.